Are the microphones useful or necessary? Does it make any difference?
I think you better use them.
Does that make any difference at all?
No, I don't think so.
Yes,
really?
Yes.
Really? Okay, makes a difference.
Corner.
Makes a difference in the corner. Normally, at these kind of events, the chair is somebody very senior and important, and he introduces two more junior people to him to do the work. But this is the world turned upside down, because both of the people here are people who I think of as being far above my station in life.
Gosh, really?
Well, after all, Javier I worked for, and Mary has been a professor since as long as I can remember. So, and I'm Robert Cooper, because I'm the least known of the three. I'm only going to do two things. First, I'm going to ask Javier to speak, and then I'm going to ask Mary to follow on. But I'm going to make one remark before I ask Javier to speak, and that is that when I read this document, or when I read most of it, I had in mind something that you said or wrote, which left a profound impression on me, and that was somebody somewhere, may have been the Balkans, was calling for the West to intervene. And you said, well, what you've got in your country, which may have well have been Bosnia, what you've got in your country at the moment is bad politics. And the answer to bad politics is not Western intervention, it's good politics. Now, I don't know if this is relevant or not, but when I read this document, I remembered this. There we are, Javier. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Robert, for your friendship. Robert is very modest, but he has been one of the most talented people that have been in the European Union corridors for at least 10 years, no more.
10 years.
10 years. And on the street of Brussels, riding a bicycle and being safe, as you see. Now, thank you very much for the invitation, Mary. I will do a little introduction, and then, Mary, and then we would like to have a discussion as you wish. Now, the topic of the diocese is security in the European Union, or the European Union and security. I agree with the statement. The question, I suggest, is a peace institution. But say that for a long time, since the economic crisis arrived in 2008, I felt the European Union sort of paralyzed and concentrate all the nerves and all the effort and energy to try to resolve, with not much success, the economic crisis. I think that the time has come to let it come back and open the thinking of the European Union and recuperate many of the things that we have abandoned because of the concentration on the economic crisis. And one of the most important things that we have abandoned and has called to our doors in a dramatic manner through refugees is foreign policy. If we had been more active during the time in which so many things were happening and we were not looking, probably the situation that we are having today would not be as dramatic as it is. So we have not only a crisis economic that still has not been completely finalized or resolved, but we have a wake-up call dramatic with the number of refugees that we have to handle. And we are not prepared to do it properly. And more grave than that is we have not been able to imagine that that could have happened. So that means that we are concentrated, that our center of gravity was not in our surroundings on the international arena, but it was more looking at ourselves. Now, I think we have to get out of that. We are talking at the moment very important in your own country. You have to take decisions in I think in 2 weeks and 2 days or something like that, and I'm not going to enter into that, but well, you know that I would like the jazz to remain to be the outcome. Now, but let me say that one of the things that I have not maintained or managed security, and I'm going to talk about security very briefly, to recognize something that has changed from the time that we did security, let's say 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Security today is a continuum between the internal security and the external security. The European Union, they look at their own security internally and think that that internal security is uncorrelated with what happens in the surroundings. And the fact of today, and we have it very clear with what happened in France, for instance, that what the questions or the problems which are outside our borders influence our borders, and what happens in our borders influences the external world. So that continuum of security is something that we have not taken a look at. And I think it would be a mistake if we recuperate our looking at the security and not having in mind that we have to look from outside, if you wish, but seeing a continuum from internal politics and external foreign policy. Internal politics, internal security, external security is a continuum. And that has many consequences. One consequence is that the possibility of creating a more united Europe is a little bit easier. Second is that probably, if you analyze properly, the elements that have to be used for internal and external security today are very common. We don't need tanks, we probably don't need so many planes, and we need much more intelligence, and we need much more capacity to deploy outside together civilians and military and judges and other functions that are necessary outside. So this idea is a continuum, and the continuum should be looked at for whoever wants to decide about what is the budget of security. And I feel I would like very much that the European Union would rather have a budget for hard security and a budget for soft security. I think it has to be a budget for security and put all the things in the same budget. And for that, I think it will be very important also in order to save some of the expenses that still we need to do in order to turn to hard security. If we look at the raw needs that we are going to have for the future needs that we may have, the type of money that has to be spent, and what I think will be very important to look at this as a continuum. Number one. Number two, the European Union is not a state. The European Union is a different animal. The states are defined because internally they use soft power, voting, laws, etc., but outside you use hard power. And I think that for us, we have to look at the operation or action that we do outside our borders, not only in the hard part of the scheme of the elements, but to have also the line, but have to say also the hard power, the soft power is just working in the states, in the European Union, also deployed together with the hard power outside. So I think that if we are able to do that, I think we will do much better operations for what we always have liked to have. The European Union is an organization for peace, not for war. We will never go to war, but we may go to have peacemaking or peacekeeping or things of that nature. And for that, I think it will be absolutely fundamental to have the vision of a unified security that may have the hard and the soft power organized together. This is the most important thing that I would like to say. And in order to do that, and I hope very much that by the month of September or by the month of August, we can begin to think in a more intense manner on security in Europe. We will be we will need to take to look in that sense. As you know, the High Representative today, Madame Mogherini, has the obligation to present a new security strategy for the European Union. The last one was done by us, by Robert Cooper and myself. The one who wrote it physically was Robert. And but I think the time has come to really take another look to the security of the world. Of those days, we were after Iraq, we wrote the first one, and now to put it up to the times of today, something very new has to be done, and very difficult. And very difficult because the world of today is more complex, and the European Union is more complex. And that is going to be a very complicated debate, long debate probably, because if you look, for instance, what is the changes which are taking place in some of the eastern part countries, Poland, Czech Republic, Hungary, from the point of view of their enthusiasm for the European Union has changed, not for the better, for the worse have changed. And therefore, to have a debate and write a document about security is going to be probably more difficult. But in any case, this is what for me is important to recuperate the importance of security in Europe. We have to play a role. Our neighborhood is probably a more delicate neighborhood today in the world. We take out the southern part of Africa or Central Africa. And if we don't want to get engaged on playing a role in security, I think it would be bad for us, and it would be bad also for our neighborhood, and it would be bad for the world at large, for the stability and in the world at large. So this is the first part of my intervention, and then Mary can continue with the document in more detail.
Thank you very much. That's fantastic. Fantastic opening. And as we go on, the number of speakers increases all the time. And, but nevertheless, next it's Mary.
Yes, and we're very happy to welcome Emily Thornbury, who we originally invited, and then she thought she couldn't come. So this is why she wasn't advertised.
That's fine.
We're absolutely delighted that she's come too. She's, for those who don't know, she's the Labour spokesman on defence. And well, anyway, it's great to be here, and it's great that Robert is chairing us, and he's much, much more important than I am. What I wanted, I just wanted to start before I get into the report by saying one thing, that what has struck me so much about the Brexit today. Oh, sorry, did you hear anything?
Well, anyway, you haven't got to the important bit yet.
I haven't, now I start. You know, what struck me about the Brexit debate is that there's never any discussion about what kind of institution the European Union is. It's true that Boris Johnson said it's a superstate and Cameron said it's not a superstate. But but it tends to be treated, at least by the exit camp, as the other, as though we aren't part of it. But the idea that it's a multilateral institution, or it's something more than a multilateral institution, it's a new kind of institution, and it has a very different kind of security policy, is never raised. And I think the security policy really illustrates the kind of institution that it is and why we need such an institution. So I wanted to say that by way of preface, because our report wasn't written for the referendum debate. Our report was written as an input into Federica Mogherini's global review. But I think it's an important point to understand that, and that this is the point that Javier was making. And it's a point, actually, that Mogherini herself made in the preliminary statement to last year's summit, which is that the EU is a new type of 21st century institution that is very different from 20th century institutions and has a very different conception of power. And I'm really echoing what Javier said. Typically, the nation state had a clear distinction between the inside and outside, and the outside was characterized by attributes of power, wealth, military force communication abilities. And the inside was all about norms, politics, rule of law. And the thing about the EU is that it kind of breaks down. And actually, security policy is much more about spreading the inside outside. It's quite different from an old-fashioned national security policy. And the big problem at the moment is that old-fashioned national security or 20th century methods simply don't work. Hardening our borders makes the situation more difficult for migrants, and the most the biggest criminals or the biggest terrorists will always find ways of getting around our border controls. Airstrikes don't deal with terrorists. They probably produce more terrorists. I had another example, but I can't remember what it was. So, what I'm trying to say is that 20th century don't work, and we really have to think about new approaches. And particularly important, and this is the focus of this report, is conflicts. I sort of feel conflicts are at the sharp end of external policy. You know, if we could deal with conflicts, we would also be dealing with refugees, we would also, ISIS and terrorism is very much a problem for conflict situations in Syria, Iraq, Mali, Somalia. And what's terribly important is they produce this criminalized predatory economy that also has huge influence on us. Many of the big profiteers, for example, of the Syrian war economy are contributing, along with Russian oligarchs, to high house prices in London. So all of those reasons are reasons why we really need to deal with conflicts. And so what our report does is to offer a new approach to conflict. What we start with is the fact that actually up to now, most interventions, whether they're from DFID or whether they're from the EU, have not been very successful. And the question is, why haven't they been successful? And all our background papers, and this actually, the work of this comes very much out of research. We have a big DFID research program in our department, and also a big European Research Council. All the papers on conflict, whether we're talking about Syria, Ukraine, Congo, the Horn of Africa, the problem is that they don't take into account the predatory, clientelistic nature of these regimes. They don't take into account the fact that contemporary conflicts are less about political contests in the way that traditional conflicts were, and they're more a kind of mutual enterprise in which various armed groups instrumentalize sectarian and religious politics and make a lot of money by loot and pillage, smuggling, all sorts of things. And so they have a sort of vested interest in the continuation of conflict, and any policy towards addressing conflict has to be thinking not so much of regime change or a top-down political solution, but how you change what is in effect a sort of predatory social condition. And that's really what our proposals are about. And because of time, I won't go into great detail on it, but I'll just say three things. I mean, in a political sense, instead of thinking about one overarching top-down agreement, the aim has to be establishing legitimate political authority, because that's the only way you can also establish a legitimate economy. And you can't do that through a top-down agreement. On the contrary, what the top-down agreements do is to embed those warring parties who are probably the most predatory. That's what we've seen happen in Bosnia. So you need a much more inclusive, long-term process that also involves a lot of activity at local levels. And again, in all our studies, we find these are very fragmented conflicts. There are local areas which are more peaceful, there are local areas which negotiate ceasefires, and we need to be able to respond to those and kind of help to build legitimacy from the ground up. So that's the first point. Then there's a security point. You know, what do we do to provide security And again, there may well be a need for what Javier calls hard security, which actually I think our kind of hard security is often soft security, without communication, not actually using force. But if you mean the deployment of troops, I think the key thing again is to try to expand safe areas. So where there are local ceasefires, then that's the moment when you actually might need to intervene with force in order to sustain those ceasefires. And Javier and I are arguing quite strongly that the European Union ought to be prepared to put European troops into Aleppo to sustain a ceasefire there, once that's been negotiated by the Russians and the Americans. And it's so important for Europe, Aleppo, because it is the source of the biggest source of the refugee crisis. And so, you know, if Europe really needs to take a role in this. And then finally, on the economy, it's terribly important to build a legitimate economy. Young men join these armed groups because they're unemployed, they offer them a salary. Our research, which we did for DFID on Syria, showed that ISIS actually offered the highest salaries. And that was a much more important motivation than other motivations. And so providing legitimate livelihoods for people so they don't, if you're in a war zone and agriculture's been destroyed, you actually have no choice but to become a criminal or to join an armed group or possibly to live on humanitarian. So that's, so we need sort of economic projects which are not necessarily about livelihoods, they may be about just switching the economy in some way so that it works. And there are lots of very concrete proposals about how you might deal with smuggling or the price of oil and so on and so forth. But again, I'm not going to talk at length because of time. And then finally, I wanted to say that we have a list of instruments that we stress for achieving all this. We put a particular emphasis on justice, which is not what has been emphasized in the past in peacemaking, and justice is often sacrificed to the requirements of peacemaking, which actually further entrenches the extremist groups. So emphasizing justice is hugely important. I won't go into all the instruments, but we also talk about creative diplomacy, meaning that diplomats have to be able to talk with civil society, they have to be able to talk at local community levels and not just on classic state-to-state levels. And another thing for the EU is a shift in conditionality. At the moment, conditionality, which is related to various agreements, is often linked to neoliberal conditions, privatizations, trade agreements. It should be linked to dealing with predation. It should be linked to corruption. So these are some of the things that are in the report. I hope you read them, and I hope you read the background. And by the way, one of the most interesting papers, which I haven't talked about at all, is the one on cybersecurity, because the EU is the only institution that has a human rights-based rather than a state-based cybersecurity policy, which is actually really interesting. But I think the final point I want to make is that I do think this is an existential issue for the European Union, actually, because the European Union is on the brink of disintegration. If we vote to leave, that will give it a push. And I actually think security policy is the area where the EU could actually gain real legitimacy. And legitimacy is very often linked to safety. If we think that an institution is keeping us safe, then that's often the essence of trust. So I think it's a really important issue. And this Mogherini report that's coming out is just one of the very few sort of positive things that's happening at the moment.
Well, let's see the report before we...
No, well, it could, no. But just the review is happening is what's positive.
And now, Emily.
Well, I came here really in order to learn, so it's a little bit odd, you know. I came along to listen to what people had to say, and I find myself on the platform. But I'm a politician, I can always talk. Give me a mic, I'll talk. I'm doing a defence review for the Labour Party. It's our policy that we are to have a root and branch review of what we think should keep Britain safe. It's very important that we look at 21st century threats and what an appropriate 21st century response is. It's always said, isn't it, that generals fight or plan to fight the previous war and not to fight the one that's coming up. But actually, we've kind of got ourselves into a situation where warfare itself has changed so fundamentally that although in Parliament we say we won't go to war without a vote of MPs, and yet we have forces in 24 different projects across the world at the moment, and we haven't had a vote on any of them, really. I mean, we have on Syria and Iraq, but otherwise, you know, all the others. And I think that the sort of the nature of classic warfare has changed. For us as a state to be involved in conflict zones around the world. And I think that also it is also becoming increasingly clear that if we ever do become involved in any conflict, we do it with allies. Now, part of that may be a political necessity, and part of that may be, frankly, a necessity in terms of what weaponry we have and whether we would have enough frigates to be able to fight a war without the assistance of other countries anyway. But parking that, I think that the other things that we really, you know, need to look at is we need to look beyond that. Because I think that as a nation, if we're looking at our defence and security, we may have these special forces here and training programmes there and, you know, bits and pieces around the world. But when we think about how to keep Britain safe, then we have to think about things in a different way. Because we have to start looking at what are the 21st century threats that are really affecting us now. I have to say, I've spoken to huge numbers of people, and the one story that's really hit me, I think, and I tell it again and again, I can't believe it, but it flips your mind when it was a flip mind, which was, so Estonia. So Estonia was part of the Russian sphere of influence. Estonia has stepped away. Russia doesn't like the status quo. But Russia doesn't send in tanks. In 2006, all the banks closed down. And they had to rely on a neighboring state in order to be able to get money out of the war. All the institutions were robocalled. And all the Russian speakers in Tallinn were text messaged and asked to drive very slowly around the center of Tallinn. These are the new tanks. This is the way you would destabilize a society, would be through things like a cyber attack. And when we talk about defense and security, I do think we need to think in terms of what is going to happen next time we are under attack. What I say on the doorstep to people, and I've been talking a lot to people about Brexit and my concern about the idea that we might lose this referendum, we might leave Europe, and I put it quite simply, which is, we're surrounded by friends. We're in one of the safest corners of the world. Why would we fall out with them? Why would we fall out with them? I know people always say, you know, oh, we'll be able to come to an agreement with our friends, they're our friends, it's all fine. It reminds me so much of when friends of mine have said that they're going to go through a divorce, but this time they're going to be adults. And 6 months down the line, they're always behaving like children. And my concern is, you know, if we leave the European Union, how much we will fall out with our friends. And that will have all kinds of ramifications. But part of it has to do with our safety, our trust, our security, and our being surrounded by friends, and being able to share information with friends, and being able to work with friends, and being able to build proper relationships, which in the end insulates us from a lot. But, you know, I think the European Union, therefore, as thinking EU strategy towards conflict and globally beyond, I think part of it is that we have to just remember the very importance of being in a society of friends, being surrounded by friends and working with them and sharing the future together. And that then means you being able to work together in terms of, you know, defending ourselves in a classic sense. And people say, well, surely you can do it. Why, you know, why do you need the EU for that? We've got NATO for that. But what strikes me is the project in Somalia dealing with the Somali pirates. So it's very different, I think, I hope you'd agree, to a classic NATO response. It isn't just, you know, people sailing the high seas and arresting pirates, and in that sort of slightly sort of swashbuckling way. But the EU policy on this, and it is an EU-led project, and it has been highly successful, is that not only have the Somali pirates on the high seas been tackled, but the EU has done much more than that. So they've actually been working on the shore as well. So they've been working with the Coast Guard, they've been working with the villages, they've been working with the fishermen. And they've been trying to, you know, establish a stability in that area that actually is the other way of tackling the pirates and wouldn't be the sort of thing that NATO would do. So I think that that kind of more joined up and perhaps slightly more, if I may say so, intelligent or 21st century approach to how one keeps us safe. And it isn't just the occasional British tourist on the, you know, on a beach getting kidnapped. It's also, you know, the seaways and trade routes and so on. That seems to me to be a very different way of contributing to the peace of the world, which I feel needs to be held up as an example of how the European Union can do things, working collaboratively, and continuing to work, I think, you know, with those on our eastern borders, and developing the strength of their societies and developing the strength of their democracies also seems to me to be another way in which we make Europe more secure. That is part of the big project of Europe, it seems to me. You don't go, it's a trite phrase, but it's true. Democracies don't go to war with one another. And so the bolstering up of our democracies on the eastern wing of Europe, it seems to me to be a very important thing. And the other work that Europe does too, and you're touching on this, you know, the work that we do as a European Union in terms of when we go to negotiations on climate change, and how the European Union has set the bar and said how much we expect to be done in terms of tackling climate change. We have constantly been pushing this, and we've spoken with one voice and been much stronger as a result of it. And if we're talking about our security, there's nothing that threatens our security more than the future of the planet. And if Europe collectively is able, through negotiations, to do something about tackling climate change, then that seems to me to be a pretty big contribution to our security as well. So it's a long way away from frigates. It's a long way away from tanks. But I do think that this is the way forward in terms of the 21st century. And I think that we need to talk about it in a way whereby people don't feel that they're losing their identity, but they're getting their identity enhanced by having a louder voice in Europe. I think that actually Britain has a fantastic position in the world, where we are surrounded by friends, we have a place in Europe, we're good friends with America, we have strong connections with the Commonwealth, most people speak English, we're in a great position. We shouldn't be feeling our identity threatened by continuing to be a member of Europe. And actually, in the end, I think that we are a stronger and safer country to be in Europe.
Thank you very much indeed. The floor is now open, but I want maybe to say one thing to begin with, to come back to Mary and the report. And that is, the three prescriptions that Mary mentioned, as I take it, form the core of the report. Establish legitimate authority. And I noted legitimate authority, not a legitimate state. And then be ready to be kind of more adventurous in terms of security. And then build a legitimate economy. I only just remark, these strike me as being quite difficult. But that's just by way of inviting other people to comment and ask questions. I guess the prime target for all of this is Mary, but anybody who wants to can answer. Even from the floor you can answer. But you have to ask first. There we are, Tony.
I'm Terry Dickens, previous director of the LSE, and I must say, whoever designed this room is completely mad, because you twist your spine, and why didn't they put the legs at the end of the room?
It wasn't
that's right.
But I'd like to ask Javier a question, as a former head of NATO and so important in the EU as well, how do you see the evolving relationship between the two? Because it's so crucial at the moment, and it's always been so ambivalent, and Europeans have been often keen to dump on NATO and flag it, but they always had recourse to military power when they need it. What kind of, how and who would shape a future relationship that would be more effective than the current one, which still has these ambivalences, still has these dislocations, still has this sort of somewhat ashamed dependence on American military power?
Well, it's a good question. I'll give the answer that I've been thinking about a lot. But it's going to be a summit, as you know, in Warsaw, the coming days, coming weeks. Well, I think that the role of NATO today is continue to be fundamentally the role of Article 5. And Article 5 is to defend a member of NATO whenever it's attacked. Is a clause of solidarity, etc. I do think that to try to get NATO involved in other things which are not really related to that, more than be helped, sometimes it complicates the issues. And it complicates the issues because in the world that we live today, in a multipolar world, in which we are seeing now the competition between the big powers, NATO is not an attractive world for many countries. And we will have to go probably to fight some other things, not only with the Americans, but we may have to go to other countries. And those countries may prefer a coalition in which NATO is not present at least explicitly, and prefer the European Union more explicit, or prefer the African Union more explicitly. And that is a problem which I think we are going to be seeing in the future more and more. And the Americans perceive that also. And I don't discover any secrets. I've been in the White House not long ago talking about these issues. And they sympathize much more with what I have said today here than what it would be said yesterday and in some other places. And even we will be happier that the summit that will take place in for the first time in a country that it was in the Warsaw Pact the first time is going to be a very difficult equilibrium, a very difficult to find an agreement at the very end. For instance, if the Poles today want to have a permanent base of NATO in their country, and I think honestly that that contradicts the founding act that I signed with the Russians at the end after the Cold War. Remember that these countries are members of NATO, but are members of NATO with certain conditions. The last military permanent should be in Western Germany, not in Eastern Germany, in Western Germany. And everything from there on will not be with permanent military headquarters. That people say that I'm the right because the agreement said in the present circumstances, but I think that the spirit was that. Now, so the relation is good. But two things I would like to say. One, the countries that are part of NATO, they are not going to spend 2% of their GDP in defense. Therefore, we have to invent the manner to be able to defend ourselves from the real challenges in a manner which is doable economically also. And for that, I think what I have said in my first intervention about talking about security internal and external, as a continuum, because the amount of money that you had to spend to maintain that is less than if you think that you are going to battle the battle with tanks, planes, etc., etc., etc. Today you need satellites, you need intelligence, you need maybe drones, but...
drones for surveillance.
Drones maybe needed, but not for the... drones, parenthesis, not to break the rules of war.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it is a very serious business. What are the rules of war? But I do think, honestly, that... we could be much better organized politically, economically, and now we have the Turks. You know, the relation between NATO and the European Union are not better because of Turkey, and not because of Turkey, for Turkey, Cyprus, not Turkey, for the moment. But it's very difficult to have a relationship which is complete. Because they don't want to, okay? But I don't want to express to explain the reason, but it's a bad relationship to operate together outside without really using all the NATO countries. An operation of Berlin Plus, for instance, which is an operation done by the European Union using NATO assets, that is a very complicated to do it because Turkey doesn't provide help they don't like it. Okay, that is what I think. Second thing is that the United States is a very important player. The United States with Obama, he preferred not to have NATO call. Third, I don't know what would happen with after the elections, but it's complicated to see. I hope that Hillary will win and there will be an Obama a little bit tougher, but be more or less on the same philosophy, which is the Bill Clinton. And I really think that is what we have to look eye to eye. And I think that the Secretary General of NATO and the Member States have to think in these terms also. And I hope that they do it. And I hope that the summit is not a summit that takes place to show to Russia that we are ready to do something. I don't think that will be the best benefit of this summit, really.
Who else? Or anybody... Mary, you want to say anything in reply to that question? But let's generate some more questions, too.
Yes. Daniele.
Okay. Thank you very much for your observations. And I think that everybody agrees in saying that the boundaries of Europe are more and more difficult to be defined. Where does Europe start? Lampedusa, Lesbo, maybe Aleppo. And there is an agreement between... Solana and Mericaldro think that the refugee crisis is creating some problems for the boundaries. Up to the point, Mericaldro suggested that Europe should do something in Aleppo. Aleppo, by the way, has quite important Roman ruins, and therefore we can consider at least archaeologically. Part of Europe,
yes, I
agree. I would like to challenge, I'm a Roman, so you understand, but I would like to challenge Mericaldro to say something more about that. Because any deployment of European soldiers in Aleppo, first of all, will require that European patrons, namely the United States on the one hand and Russia on the other hand, agree on that. Second, if I remember well what Mericaldro argued at the time of the Yugoslavian crisis, where your position was a bit different from the position of Dr. Solana, you argued very much that the military intervention should have been combined with other activities involving civil society, involving non-military means. And how do you think this is going to be feasible in the case of Aleppo?
Well, that's a nice question to answer. First of all, I want to say one thing to Tony, which is I'm really sorry about this room. It was the only room we could
well,
get.
Well, we were in the worst
in the
position.
Middle of the downs, and it was the only day of May that Javier could come here.
Right.
So we had to compromise on the room. And it's terribly difficult to find, apart from anything else. So, sorry about the room, everybody. That's number one. I think your leopard... I mean, I was doing very much shorthand in what I was saying. But Aleppo is a nice example, but it might not only be Aleppo. Absolutely. What we argued, and we argued it to Javier when he was High Representative, and he did sort of agree, but he was High Representative, was that actually what you need is not exactly military forces, but something we called human security forces that combines civil and military, that combines a whole, that has police, that has development experts, and so on and so forth, that can be deployed in different combinations. That's number one, so I'm not really talking. And even when you're using military, just like the anti-piracy mission, which actually is a great model, and they said, what's his name? Admiral...
They keep changing.
Yeah, but he was very influenced by the human security report. And he did. We did a report for Javier on human security. And when he did the anti-piracy mission, he explicitly said that he was really influenced by that report in what he did in the anti-piracy mission. So it's really interesting. That. So, and here's a case where the military aren't trying to defeat somebody. They're trying to protect people, keep order, and if necessary, arrest people. But that's very different from defeating them militarily. So that's on the security side. On the question of will the Russians and the Americans agree, of course it wouldn't be without agreement. And what we've been arguing, and we have Reem here in the audience who might well like to add, because she and I have been working together on Syria. The issue really is, and this is linked to your point about authority, we deliberately didn't say state, because a legitimate political authority could be a municipality. Or the key thing is a political institution that people trust. And so the idea is that you support, I mean, Aleppo is an odd example, but we've been arguing very much in other cases of local ceasefires, which are very fragile, which are organized by local people and by civil society people. There, that's where you need to come in and support them. So it's not a matter of just coming in from the outside and intervening. And as there would be no question without an agreement. I mean, what we're actually proposing is that the European Union should make it clear that if there were an agreement on Aleppo, there should be some kind of, ideally, a human security force which would monitor, mediate at a local level. So that's the sort of proposal that we're trying to put forward.
If I kind of could interrupt there
and
ask, agreement with whom? There has to be an agreement. But an agreement with the people on the ground who want you there, for sure. But then does that mean you must have an agreement with the Syrian state too?
Well, if the Russians and the Americans were able to negotiate a ceasefire in February, this meant that the Russians were bringing the Syrian state on board. Yes, of course the Syrian state has to be involved. All the parties to the conflict have to agree to a ceasefire.
I think it's a very noble suggestion, idea. But I think in reality, and you may disagree with me, but I think if we were able to get an agreement in Aleppo, there is no reason why we couldn't get an agreement on everything in Syria. Aleppo is probably the most difficult place because it has a further border with Turkey. Turkey is complicated, etc., etc. So if we were to find a very complicated place, that is what is intelligent for Mary to put that case, because obliges the European Union to define if it would be ever be able to do something. But I mean, Aleppo is not going to be solved very separated in the solution of the whole problem. And let me say that on diplomacy, Mary has insisted on diplomacy. Let me put an example. The agreement that was done with the European Union and the members of Security Council, permanent members, plus the European Union and Germany, on the nuclear issue, it was really diplomacy and tenacity at its best. I remember a picture that impressed me very much, the last days when the Kerry was with crunches, no? Because he was, okay. So it was really a role of resolving that problem. Now, I told them the day after, why don't you get together in a week and continue working on getting peace in Syria? At least get the big powers in agreement on what would be the parameters for Syria. And at that time, the momentum was there to resolve it, because you have that meeting, and then 2 days later or a week later, you get together the Iranians and the Iraqis and Turkey, and you have the... Now, why it was not done? But it was not done for a stupid relation of Saudis, the United States, the Emirates, instead of really being much more courageous. Now, it was the problem was, well, we have given something to Iran. We cannot now resolve Syria we have to give something to the Saudis first. And, we gave something to the Saudis first, which is time, and time is the only thing we should not have given, because we have 5 years already. 5 years of that war. Time is the only thing we cannot give in this case. No? But these type of things, which are really of political nature, which are still in the world in which we live today, multipolar, etc., we have not been able to resolve how you handle these things. So, I don't continue. I will enter later.
Yes.
Yeah.
Portion of the war. And I think that there is a scenario in Syria that repeated itself, that armed opposition built into a civilian populated area. And then the regime comes in and launched aerial attacks against this area as a punishment for the people. And most of the casualties would be civilians. Now, the armed opposition would be reluctant to leave because many reasons, one of which is that they say, even if we give up ourselves, we think the regime is going to.
Given the terrible acoustics, if you can shout, this would be
maybe
better.
If you stand up.
Or just stand up.
Or you can come and borrow a microphone.
So, just going back to this political scenario where the opposition has only ground troops and the regime have control over the sky. So, every time they go into civilian populated areas, the regime come and retaliate and. Show you all the civilians' areas, the populated markets as a punishment. And then the opposition even, because I've seen cases where the opposition will say, okay, we'll withdraw from the area so that the regime stops the shelling, but who would guarantee our safety? Who would guarantee the safety of those civilians in this area? We need someone to secure them. We don't trust the regime to do so. So to prevent this security vacuum, the idea of having peacekeepers or European security forces was put on the table, but maybe they can be the power which goes into these towns, like the part of Aleppo that is under opposition control, for example, and keep it safe until there is a more permanent solution on the table, until there is a power or authority that has control over the army or new security forces that can go and secure this area. So it's the only temporary measure to fill this security gap in the civilian population. And I think it's been required in many areas in Syria. It's a pity that, the only time it happened in 2012, and only 270 monitors, unarmed monitors, were sent to Syria. And they were insufficient, there was no peace plan, and still we've seen a reduction of 25% the number of casualties in 3 weeks. Nothing in Syria so far have achieved this.
Thank you very much. I have two questions at this. Let's take both questions first, and then the panel can pick and choose. Both from ladies, one in the front row and one two rows back.
Thank you very much. Let me push you about Syria and about negotiations. You mentioned Russia and the US.
Or come and borrow a microphone if you'd like.
So I'll speak up as much as I can. So let me push you about Syria and Russia and the US and Russia in Syria. I just want to remind that in the Ukraine crisis, we had somehow this agreement between Russia and the US, the Minsk agreement, and the ceasefire is not followed by the parties, so we still have ongoing conflict there. And how do we get a guarantee that it might work in Syria? And to comment about the human security force, there is something very much alike in South Ossetia, between Georgia and South Ossetia. It's called EU Monitoring Mission, which is an unarmed force of EU representatives who kind of monitor the border. But Russians still have these border engineering works, and they, from time to time, when they need to have this topic in the news, they move border into Georgia proper, and it's a permanent issue. So if there is no trust, how are we going to bring this issue into working? Thank you very much.
Can I take the second question here, and then everyone can answer both of them?
Based on our international security department at Chatham House. My question is something that I want from NATO, so let me talk a little about that. So in NATO, we have this smart defense approach that Secretary General Rasmussen put forward, and the idea was going for the collective defense framework where you're pooling and sharing the capabilities of the states. So if we model this type of an understanding for a smart security, for the European understanding, for the European Union, I really wonder where would the small states in the EU would lie in terms of human security forces that Mary Calder was mentioning about.
So two very different questions. One question, to put it in summary, why should anybody trust the Russians in Syria given the way they behave everywhere else? Second question, is a bit more technical about NATO models of smart security and how they could be applied to EU countries.
Maybe.
Too technical for me.
But no, no,
small
maybe Javier can answer
small
that
things.
One.
But Javier.
The trust is with Russia. I'm glad that you brought the question of that border. Because in 2008, during the Olympic Games, Beijing Olympic Games, remember it was the moment in which Georgia and Russia, and remember that in those days, in Beijing was everybody, the President of the United States, the President of Russia, everybody you can count. And in any case, that happened. And it was not stopped by a conversation in Beijing with one of the leaders. Now, it had to take some time, and the European Union agreed with, at that time, the president with Medvedev, and we agreed to deploy a police, I mean, we were Spanish and French, the Guardia Civil, the Spanish, and the gendarmerie, which are hard police, but policemen. And it was in 15 days, it was resolved that border. Now the presence is a little bit less, I think, but this OSCE is not a European Union at this point. It's OSCE. Now, the question of Syria trusting Russia is a less delicate for the Russians. They can get an agreement better. Ossetia, remember that this territory that they claimed is their neighborhood. But Syria, they have the only military base that the Soviet Union head outside the territory of the Soviet Union, the only one, was in Syria. And that base the Russians want to keep it. But I think that the agreement with the Russians is the influence that they are going to have with that base, and it's not impossible to do it. It's not impossible to get an agreement. But the problem is to get an agreement between the Iranians and the Saudis. Because that disagreement between the Iranians and the Saudis prevent to get an agreement on the whole thing. Because the Russians, I think that will be easy to get on the package. They were in the package on Iran, and very constructive, never put any difficulty on the Iran negotiation. Once you recognize, they wanted to have in that negotiation in Iran, just to make, they sell or to the, they sold to the Russians their defenses. No problem with that, and then the agreement was done. And I think that if we were intelligent enough to give them something on the base, the big problem continues to be Saudi Arabia and Iran. That those are the ones which is Iran through Hezbollah is supporting the Assad and the Iranians with everything that they can put it to support the others and the other. So I really think that it's very difficult, but it will be easier to have a convincing agreement with Russia in Syria, if it's done, than what it is in Ossetia. Because Ossetia, they like to play with that border because it's theirs. It's a border with Russia. But in Syria will not be a border with Russia. So I think it will be easier to get an agreement. I wouldn't guarantee you that, because I cannot guarantee, but I'm very close to that. Now, the second thing is on the smart security. I think that smart security is what the European Union does, or should do, and is more proper to be done in the mixture of military plus civilian operations than military alone. The really smart security is to do all these things together. And that is what we are talking about. The real smart security is what we propose. It's the real one, which is police, military, judges, teachers, whatever is necessary to construct an operation whereby in a place of conflict you reconstruct any state. And reconstructing a state is a very difficult thing. You don't do it in 24 hours, and you don't need only military. The military cannot reconstruct a state.
I wonder about the small European state's role in that.
The small state. The small have a very important role to play, because they don't have probably the hard part of the line, but in the soft part, they may have more facility with languages. In the Poland, in the border with Ukraine, they have even the facility of the language that they can communicate. So everybody has a role to play, not the same level of role, because nobody has planes and nobody has tanks. Well, everybody has tanks still, unfortunately, but I think that is everybody has a role to play in this type of operation.
Maybe I could just add one word to that. Your neighbor could probably say something about it as well. But my experience is that if you're trying to put together any kind of operation, military operation, peacekeeping operation, whatever, there are some capabilities that are extraordinarily difficult to get hold of which the most important one normally turns out to be medical. And actually, small states are just as capable of doing that as large states. So I think that if small states would provide, and actually, I also remember mobile laundry units as being a problem somewhere. Most people have got these stuff. The stuff that small states don't have is missile defense systems and this kind of things. That you need pretty rarely.
But so not I even the big ones.
Small states have got a lot to do.
Can I say something about Aleppo? Because I visited Aleppo 6 or 7 years ago. I don't remember the Roman ruins, but I remember there was a castle, and the castle was an Arab castle which had never been conquered. And I remember being there today.
They don't understand
me. Across Aleppo. And there were many, many different...
Something important.
I began to understand how complex and extraordinary Syria was, and how very disappointed I was that when the civil war broke out, and when there were client organisations, so the Saudis had their paid people, and all the, you know, all the various conflicts around the world, everybody had their clients that they were in their fight. And we were as crass as we were in terms of our assessment of what was going on. And the idea that we could go in and to be seen to be doing something. We had no idea about what our strategy was or what it was that we hoped to
achieve.
And it seemed to me that it was one of the most complex sort of multifaceted civil wars. And I weighs very heavily on me. Because I think about Aleppo and I think about what an amazing place it was and what must be left of it now and exactly how we can have been bombing to break 1,000 feet and been actually helping that situation. Because clearly, you know, even if we were to be successful in clearing the ground of Daesh, let's say, which is what's constantly being said, what happens to that void? You know, I think it's a point that was made elsewhere. You know, you clear a void and then what fills it? You know, if you don't have anything to fill it, then you certainly won't ever get peace. So I'm interested in what you say, particularly about Aleppo, because Aleppo is what really pulls on my heart, because I remember Aleppo very well. But I don't know why it would be that European force would necessarily have a different character or be more important to doing this work than the United Nations. And I'm constantly, again, equally concerned about how we undermine, you know, United Nations, which I know has weaknesses and I know they have weaknesses. But if people just keep ignoring it and say, oh, we won't be able to do that, we'll do it instead, it also continues to erode it.
Can I just say, I would imagine this as a UN force.
Right.
I was really and the big, of course, the EU would be offering to fulfill a UN mission. There would be no question otherwise. And of course, one of the big problems is, which we somehow were discussing earlier today, is that the EU is not a member of the Security Council, and it would make such a difference to all of this if it was the EU in the Security Council rather than Britain and France. But that's something that is actually not on the table.
Not for the foreseeable future, not during the referendum.
Robert, were you going to add something
about
Russia?
Mary, is that an argument to convince the Brits that they should vote for Brexit?
Exactly.
That the European Union...
You just don't mention
that.
Well, actually, as a matter of fact, this is not what we're supposed to talk about, but as a matter of fact, I've heard one of the people campaigning for Brexit saying the reason we have to get out is that if we stay in, the EU will end up taking our seat in the Security Council. The audience pointed out to the Dr. Fox, who said this, that this actually required a positive vote from the UK government. And he said, yes, but you never know what the UK government is capable of. there's somebody, two gentlemen at the back. And so with political correctness, we now go over to the left.
Thank you very much for your talk. It was very educational. My name is Thomas. I'm doing a master's in European politics here. And my question is, after reading for an entire year about how the lack of unity of European member states, especially in the sectors of defense and security, can you really hope for a EU strategy, a unique EU strategy? I mean, looking at what's happening in Mali, in Libya, and Syria, everybody's got their own plans. is it possible, realistically, to have a European peace project and a European...
That's question one, and then question two.
I'm Mitchell Jovirovic, native of former Yugoslavia, and in fact of Belgrade, which is the only capital in the world that has been bombed by both NATO and the Nazis, so you know straight away where I'm coming from. Especially if you focus on justice and trust when it comes to the European Union. The fact is that 90 NATO countries in 1999, and Mr. Solana will know it very well because he was Secretary General of them at the time, all those 1940 were EU member states, and they've gone to war against the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, and in doing so, they've flagrantly broken the UN Charter, a document which they had all solemnly signed. And the question then, in terms of trust, is raised. What is the signature of those countries now really worth? Mr. Putin in Russia frequently points out the 99 NATO aggression, as he calls it, against Yugoslavia. What trust can be put in those countries when the most solemn document on which the whole of the UN is based is simply ignored? And if I can also say to Mary Calder briefly, on the issue of justice, etc., which requires objectivity and neutrality of those who are going to defend. I think that once you have intervened, you cannot be neutral. Once you bomb someone, that's it for the next 50 years. If I could have somebody, you know, dispense justice, please let's have Russia or China, because they haven't dropped a single bomb on the Balkans. And by the way, they wouldn't be neutral either of them. Because, like all countries, they would look after their own interests first. But because they haven't done any bombing, because they haven't broken the UN Charter, there would be an order of magnitude closer to any neutrality or objectivity that would be required in any pursuit.
Well, this was a very long question. Thank you very much. First, there was Thomas's question about... how on earth can the EU have a strategy when it never agrees on anything? Javier can answer that, well, and then so can I. And then there was a question, a rather long statement, rather more than a question, about the UN Charter and the Kosovo campaign.
Look, on the European Union may take some time to agree on some issues, but in others, that's necessarily. During my time, we did more than 20 operations outside the borders of the European Union, in Africa, in many places, once military, others police, others civilians, etc., etc. We were in making peace in Indonesia. The most important peace in Indonesia was done by the European Union, taking advantage of the tsunami. After the tsunami, we went rapidly. It was an agreement impossible to... It was done. So there are moments in which we really get together rapidly. We have been controlling the elections militarily, the elections in Congo, plus an operation of... peacemaking in Congo. So I do think that it's possible to get together rapidly on Chad, for instance. We were there for a long time without much... the leader country at that time was Ireland, but every country participated. So we have done things very surprising. If we look at today back, in those years, it was possible to do much more than today, which is surprising, because, as time goes by, we should have done it better. But I think that the break of the international economic crisis has been so profound, so that has created such a depression, in a way, in the citizens of the European Union also, that it's much more difficult to do it. But it's possible to do it. There's no reason why it's impossible to do it, because it has been done. It's not the first time. It has been done during 5 or 10 years, 20 times.
Maybe on this question, mm-hmm. I can also add something. Having worked with you, Javier, and then with your successor for a while in the European Union, the newspapers always report the European Union is split on something or other. This is a much better story than the European Union has agreed on something or other. My experience is the European Union always agrees. There is always some outcome. They don't always agree on the most ambitious policy, but there is always an agreement. The only question is, how far does the agreement go? So I've no doubt the European Union will agree on a global strategy. Much more important and much more difficult is agreeing on particular strategies on particular places. And if you ask me how you do that, my answer is you do that by getting yourself a first-class European diplomatic service which has first-class people on the ground, which really know what's happening, and that's where you should begin getting the agreement. And that's what I would do. It I would build it from the bottom up. Then we have a question on Kosovo, and the question with that is where to stop, because this is a discussion which can go on for hours.
Where to stop the...
How can you be trusted if you're not respecting the UN Charter and flagrantly breaches?
I just make one remark to that and say that when it comes to breaches of the UN Charter, it seems to me that Crimea is also a problem.
In response?
Not to mention what's going on in the Donbass.
Well, I what I can tell you about those days, those events, which I know very well, is that it was a complete unanimous, autonomous decision by all the members of the European Union that were in NATO and the members of NATO. And I have to tell you also that right after the end, Mr. Kofi Annan came to Brussels and made a press conference with me and saying that he had contemplated that as an operation to save people that were in the hands of somebody who was condemned by the International Tribunal called Milosevic. Well, I cannot say more, but those are the records there. The interpretation, but you have one, I have the other. I can tell you they were not my happiest days in my life, but I think at the end of the day that is better than what we had at the time.
I guess we have time for one more question, if it lasts no longer than 1 minute, and then the answer will last no longer than 2 minutes. I saw you first, I'm afraid. Oh, there are two of you. You can each ask half a question.
The question is kind of huge. it's actually a good question. What do you think about the relationship between the EU and Russia, since we've talked quite a lot, I would say, about Russia today and the fact that it does play a huge role, especially in the Eastern countries where we have huge problems. So how do you think that this relationship should go on, and do you think that we should have some kind of like an institutionalized relationship with them, the same we have as members of NATO with the US, or do you think that we should do it in a way with Russia?
I think that's a good question.
Okay, so I was going to wait for a second. Well, I think that the European Union with Russia has to make a very, very solid effort to maintain relationships. To cut off relations with Russia will be, to my mind, a mistake. Russia is part of the continent and is our border, and it's not the same Russia for the United States that's for Europe. For the United States, Russia is another military power with nuclear weapons and big power. For us, it's a neighbor. It's a, apart from that, it's a neighbor that provides now gas and to many countries of the European Union. So we have to have that into consideration. Now, we have to be very tough when we think that Russia doesn't behave, but at the same time, we have to know that Russia is going to be with us forever. And I would like to say something to my Russian friends. Russia continues to be a country where you go to any airport or any shopping center or shopping mall, you never find anything made in Russia. You find things made in Japan, but you get Kalashnikovs, but that is about the only thing. No, therefore, the modernization of Russia only will come through the European border. So the European border with Europe, Russia, is the most important. They are not going to get modernization by China, by the China border, because demographically, that is a border that will be controlled. The Chinese will come close to the border, not crossing the border, close to the border, and it will continue to be entering the Russian side. So the only border really where transfer can happen is Europe. So to maintain a good relation with Russia is fundamental. But of course you have to be tough in the question where you have to be tough.
Can I say something? I mean, I think the... clearly, things have changed enormously in East-West relations over the last few years, and I think that and people say, you know, why is it that Russia behaves in the way that it is? It's being so aggressive. Putin has a strategy. Blah, blah, blah. I don't think he does. I think that there is an expression of unhappiness of the Russians. They don't like the current status quo, and I think that we're supposed to have a whole kind of backbone is there's supposed to be a mesh of different negotiations, of different relationships that we're supposed to have with Russia. But someone said to me, it's like a sort of very old and satty spiderweb. It's completely falling apart, and we're hardly speaking to the Russians either at the European level or at NATO level. And there are not the conversations that should be happening, and you know, there's a build-up of you know, Russia is investing in its military, Europe is investing in its military, and there are not the conventions. And I was saying earlier
that Poles wanting to have
bases in Poland and so on, and clearly that's a contravention of various agreements. We have to be so careful with a delicate relationship like this, not to advance. And if we're not talking, then that in itself is a threat to our security.
Just one comment. But why only Europe has to be delicate and not Russia? That's my question.
Why
one party has to be delicate and the other not?
Why do we have to treat them so sensitively when they don't necessarily treat us very sensitively?
Yeah, that's kind of...
Well, because what's the alternative? I mean, I don't think the alternative is a great one. You know, I mean, I think the alternative is for us to allow ourselves to be provoked, to allow ourselves to become increasingly militaristic, to allow us to continue to invest in forces and to square up to Russia. I don't think that's a great future for Europe. And I think that, you know, we need to think about, you know, again, what is the end game? What is it that we want? And as you were saying, you know, Russia will always be our neighbour. We need to have a decent relationship with it. And going through a phase, falling into another Cold War, I don't think will help anyone.
Well, maybe I add my two cents worth. and Mary as well. I'm in favour of talking to Russia continuously as well. But I think that the quality and the content of the talk has to depend on reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality at the moment is that Russia is in illegal occupation of Crimea and has illegally forces in east of Ukraine and has a constant flow of weapons and ammunition there for no good reason in the world. And whenever we have a discussion with Russia, it seems to me that we need to remind them that this behavior is very difficult to understand, to say the least. But Mary.
And I'd like to add something too. First of all, I think
that to militarize a military response to Russia is exactly what Putin wants.
Yeah.
It feeds into his narrative. So I think the worst thing to do in response to what he's doing is a militaristic response. Secondly, I wanted to say something Emily said at the beginning about Estonia. And the Russians have this whole theory, sinister theory of non-linear war, whereby you destabilize a country through supporting domestic opposition and you send in the special forces and the weapons. And all of that was spelt out before Eastern Ukraine began, and they followed it completely. So then if you ask why did they do this, they did it, in my view, because democracy in Ukraine would have meant exposing the criminal links between Russian and Ukrainian oligarchs, and especially the European agreement, and would have promoted the democracy movement in Europe, in Russia, which actually is very much in our interests. So my view is the most important thing we could do is to go on pushing for democracy in Ukraine and for transparency and all of those issues. That's the way to deal with Russia, I think. And I agree with Javier about changing the economy, because the way Russia behaves is not because it's communist, not because it's Russian, but because it's an oil state. It just behaves like Iraq does or Saudi Arabia does. And so changing the nature of... So that's the way to change it. And that also says something about our own energy policies.
Yep. Stop using oil.
Stop using oil.
Yeah.
is a solution to all these totalitarian, authoritarian states.
Yeah.
We've got to close. I just wanted to say a couple of final points. One is,
you have a question, then, didn't you?
I think we've got to go.